Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and it seems like the topic of mental health and mental health treatment is surging to the forefront of many conversations as we face. I don't think I really need to restate what we, as a planet, are facing. What follows is an honest discussion about depression and suicide. My younger sister Jen has been living with severe depression for years, possibly for her entire life. She's had some counseling, tried medication, and leaned hard on primarily our mother. Before I continue, I did ask her if I could talk about her in the context of this interview on the radio, and she said, sure, I struggle with this every day. Tell some people. Right before we all started staying home as the global COVID-19 pandemic revved up in the United States, my sister left her husband. It was the right choice, and one I'd hoped would come for ages. Now she calls me several times a day to check in, visit, and often rant, vent, and/or cry. Sometimes she puts my niece on a video call with me so I can remote babysit while she goes and takes a breath. I'm talking to my sister all the time. I'm listening, I'm asking questions, I'm offering suggestions, I'm drawing on my own experience in therapy. But we've both felt pretty helpless in the face of her depression. And I admit, I've been frustrated sometimes because I don't understand how it feels. The spiral that spins her as a person with severe depression is not the same as the spiral that spins me. John Moe is a critically and popularly acclaimed public radio personality and the creator and host of the podcast The Hilarious World of Depression. His new memoir takes the same name as the podcast, and in it he shares what he's learned from doing interviews with comedians, actors, musicians, and others about their depression, and from living with, recognizing, and treating his own mental illness. John Moe is a broadcaster, a writer, and a great Twitter follow. In the book, he puts into words what depression does to those who experience it. As I read, every few pages, I found myself highlighting large swaths of text to remind myself to revisit them, to check in with them when I forgot how desperate my sister feels. I'm not sure how much I can help her, but I'll never give up. And with John's help and what's in his book, I have a better idea of how the illness blocks out her vision and tries to keep her underwater. I love her. She knows how much. But almost every day, almost every minute, her depression tells her that no one loves her. It's a nightmare. But just like when you were a kid and you went to your parents' room after a nightmare woke you up, people with depression and other mental health issues often do have somewhere to go, someone to turn to. I'll post links to several hotlines in the web post of this interview at WAMC.org, and I'll recommend John Moe's book to everyone. You might be depressed and could read the book and see you're not alone. You definitely know someone who lives with mental illness, and like me, this book may help you understand them better. Once again, the name of John Moe's book is The Hilarious World of Depression. It's published by St. Martin's Press, and he joins us now. John Moe, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you so much.
I'm very excited to speak with you. We have been co-followers of each other on Twitter for years and years and years. But this is the first time we've ever spoken, which is what happens with Twitter.
Well, in the old days when I did radio shows before the spaceships came, I had these national shows, so I thought, well, I better just follow every regional person I can think of. And so I followed just all these people, and then I realized, oh, this won't mean my show gets picked up anywhere in particular. And so many of these people are dreary. So you're one of the few that I held on to after the great purge of reassessing my life, because, you know, we became pals by then.
Yeah, definitely. So your book and your podcast, The Hilarious World of Depression, come, of course, from a story that now you've been telling for years and years and years and years, and a lot in the last few weeks, of course. But could you give us the sort of Cliff Notes summary for our jumping off point today?
So I've been hosting a show for a while, since 2016, talking to professional creative people, a lot of comedians, some musicians and writers and actors, you know, an entrepreneur or two, just creative thinkers who have dealt with depression personally. And I get the story from them of what it's like to live with it, but also what it is, because depression is so hard to define. I've never seen a satisfactory, like, textbook definition of it. So that's why so much of what we do in the show is through analogy, through metaphor, simile. And so, yeah, I've been doing that for a few years, and what we thought was going to be a charming and very obscure little series of interviews about this thing turned into kind of a phenomenon. It became very popular, and now it's a book. So after dozens and dozens of interviews of me asking about other people's stories, this one is mostly about my story and how I came to know depression and then deal with it for many years, then learn what it was had a name and was called depression, and sort of the beginning of my advocacy around that topic. A lot of it came about because of Twitter. Years ago, my brother died by suicide after an undiagnosed and untreated depression. And on Twitter, I had a platform. I made a bunch of jokes. You know, I had some radio shows. People knew who I was. So I would occasionally break the format of dad jokes and and get into real sincere messages about mental health, about depression, about suicide. The rate, we're at a 30-year high in suicides, and encourage people to take it seriously and get it treated. And it just caught on like wildfire. And that's what led to the podcast, because, I mean, I think I can write a good tweet. I think I can string some sentences together, but I think there was just a real hunger in society right at that moment to talk about it more openly.
And you always start those threads by saying, this is what I'm about to do. Like, buckle up. We're going to get real about this.
Yeah. Well, I try. I mean, in everything, I try to, I guess in radio, we call it forward promote, but also give a warning. Like, you know, I'm going to lay this down. This is going to take a little while. In the same way that, you know, I was on Fresh Air recently, and I made sure when I posted that on various social media to say, trigger warning here, there's some very frank discussion about suicide in this conversation. And I think that helps people get in the right mindset to kind of open up about it.
In The Hilarious World of Depression, your book, you write about many, many encounters and brush-ups with trying to treat depression that you've had. I would say, I mean, you get the benefit of hindsight in laying it out in the book at this point in your life, but it took you getting closer and closer to feeling better and better. But as we know, mental illness never isn't curable, but it's, you know, treatable. You can sort of get better at handling it for yourself. It seems like every time you took a step toward it, toward treating it, toward diagnosis, toward sticking with a therapist, toward medication, you would slip back. But then what has made you work harder on it, if that's the appropriate phrasing, which it might not be?
Yeah, I think it's fine phrasing. I think a few things kind of helped me really get to a better place. One of them was the show and just doing all these interviews, learning about how depression manifests in other people and really the similar pathology. You know, like it's a scatter graph, but you can trace the trend lines, right? And so I was learning about what I dealt with was pretty similar to what a lot of other people dealt with. And so knowing your opponent is the best way to fight the opponent. So that helped a lot. And that helped me kind of boil down the truth of what I was really up against. I had sort of taken an approach for many years of, I've stopped it from getting worse and I'm not in any danger and I feel steady. And that was good enough through like two full seasons of doing a show about depression. But I got this book deal to write this memoir. And I said, well, if I'm going to write a book about something, I better know my topic. And that pushed me to get into some therapy. And also just being, I was coming up on 50 and I thought, well, I better, if I'm going to get better, I better do it soon. Because, you know, I'm getting older. And I wanted to get better, and I figured out a way to get better through picking a therapy that sounded like it was right for me. I always say, nothing's right for everybody. You got to find your own way. This seemed like a good way for me. I hit it off with the therapist. We were on the same page, and it just really worked out. And so that story is kind of in the book, too. So the book is almost a character in the book, but... It's funny, I'd found this therapist and scheduled an appointment, and then I emailed her before our first appointment. I said, you should know, I have this program, I have this podcast where I talk about depression, and if it is helpful to you, here's a link. And she wrote back and said, yeah, I know who you are. I'm familiar with the show. And it was sort of like, yeah, you're in the Twin Cities and you do psychology. You know who John is doing his show.
You mentioned a few moments ago that you helped describe what depression feels like for you and what you've, gleaned that it feels like for other people from speaking with them through a lot of analogies. And in one paragraph I highlighted it immediately, and I asked you before we started recording if you would read it. Could you read me the normies and saddies are different paragraph,
Yeah.
please?
I wrote this pretty early and I had a long series of doubts about keeping this because I stretched the metaphor pretty far. But this is one that a lot of people seem to find helpful. And yeah, we call people who don't deal with depression normies just in around the office when we're planning the show, and then people with depression, saddies. And there's way more to depression than sadness. But it's shorthand, like it's production shorthand. We're like, oh, I'm gonna get see if I can get Paul F. Tompkins on the show. Is he a saddie? I thought he was a normie. No, total saddie.
Yeah, total saddie. I adore him. I'm so glad you talked to him so much.
Oh, he's great. All right, here we go. Normies and saddies are different, you see. Let's say there's a long bridge going over a high canyon, and there are two cars on it, one for the normies and one for the saddies. The normies are in a big land yacht of a Buick, weighs a ton, low to the ground. When a stiff wind blows, the normies feel a mild push but continue driving, perhaps casually noting that it's getting windy out there. Then they go back to listening to, I don't know, Foo Fighters. The saddies are piled into a Model T with a sail on top of it for some reason. They see the wind coming, and it's all they can do to keep from being blown off the road and plunging into the canyon. The normies see the saddies struggle and wonder what the problem is because to them, the wind doesn't seem that bad. Try being more positive, the normies shout as the saddies' Model T goes tumbling off the side and the saddies deploy the parachutes they've gotten used to wearing.
So I asked my sister if I could talk about her in this interview. My sister has severe depression, and we are getting increasingly close because she recently left her husband. So she and my niece, and they're in Saranac Lake, New York, which is upstate from here, in Albany. So I'm working from home. I'm more available than usual because I'm working, but I'm not at the office. And she's going through this huge thing during the global pandemic,
Oof.
and so I'm not obviously a qualified therapist, but I'm a little bit filling that role in her life as well as just a, family support structure.
Yeah.
And your book just opened my eyes, I would say almost on every page, to have a better understanding of what she is up against and what she's coping with. And that was one of the things. So I was like, I'm not full normie, but
Yeah.
there's insight into the depression that is, it was so helpful, John. I mean, I guess this is a early thanks for writing it that I maybe should have saved for the end, but I can't believe you're such a wonderful writer. You're so good with words, and then you're so open, and so the exploration is just, I mean, I just can't imagine how much the book must be helping people if it's just in my house helping just me.
Well, it sounds like it, if it helps you to help your sister, and I would say too that you're modeling something that I've always tried to get across, which is, the fundamental epiphany for me came at my brother's memorial service, where all these friends of my parents were coming up to talk to me, and of course, Rick, my brother, should have been at their funerals one day, so it was a world out of balance, and they would talk about how great Rick was when he was a kid, and how their memories of him on camping trips where we'd go with other families, and these pranks that he would play, and his sense of humor. And at this service, I said, "Well, yeah, that's all true, but that ends like when Rick was like 13 or 14. After that, he struggled with ADHD and dyslexia, which of course weren't diagnoses at the time. They just thought he was a bad kid, and he fell into drugs, and like pot turned into coke, turned into methamphetamine, and he was homeless. And then he got himself straightened out, and he was helping people. And then he had this mental illness that nobody knew was this bad. And at this point, the friends of the family are starting to edge away to talk to more
Yeah.
agreeable family members."
Right. They're like, we just wanted to say, what a
We
good
just,
kid, right?
right,
Right.
this is what we do at services. And I just thought, it's not what we should do because, I mean, I come from a news background, and so you want to get the facts of what's going on in the story. You don't want to, You don't want to just cover up the unpleasant bits. It's you're trying to serve the truth to help people. And I thought, well, we're at a crossroads. We can not talk about these things. If you're experiencing them, you can keep quiet about it. You cannot get any help. And it's probably going to get worse. Or you can talk. You know, a lot of people think that means you have to go to a psychiatrist or a therapist, but not everybody has insurance. Not everybody can afford it. Talk just means talk to someone. And if it's a therapist, great. If it's your sister, great. If it's clergy, if it's your parents, if it's your book club, whoever it is that you feel best about opening up to. If we do that, it has every chance in the world of getting better. And so at that service, I'm like, fine, I'll be the loudmouth. I'll be, you know, I'm the loudmouth anyway. Somehow I was born in a Norwegian family. It makes no sense because I just share everything. And that's really where that came from. So I think, you know, it sounds like in a lot of ways, your sister is very much on the right track.
She had therapy before. And so sometimes she tells me that was good. She learned some tools. But they just don't work. And I'm like, okay, yeah. Well, we're not done. Like, you didn't go to therapy a time and now you have all the tools.
We've done a whole show about this. There's no such thing as therapy as a monolithic thing. It's all individual relationships. It's like collaborating with someone on an artistic thing. Like, some people you'll collaborate with well, some people you won't. Some people it seems like you would, but there's no chemistry. And then there's all the different techniques and modalities that you can use. So, you know, therapy, I believe, works. It's just that it sometimes takes an infuriatingly long time to make a connection.
People often say that finding the right therapist is like dating, which you also say in your book. But I really like that idea of it being collaborating with somebody more than dating, because then, you know, it takes some of the personal and sex stuff out of it.
Right. I had some lines in my book where I said I had a brief fling with a dialectic therapist for a few days, and my editor was like, you need to change that because it sounds like you slept with your therapist. I'm like, okay, that's fair.
And would that be a bad idea?
That would be generally bad. No, I mean, the dating analogy is sort of tenuous because my wife and I have been together since 1991. But yeah, it's a collaboration. It's it's working with someone, really. You're trying to solve a puzzle. You're trying to unlock something.
So you have, by a lot of measures, been very successful in your career. There have been, you know, setbacks, but huge buoying events. Yeah. And you felt just still like you were a complete failure a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. Could you explain that? I mean, it's the depression taking over, but could you talk about that some more?
When you've been depressed for a long time, and as far as I know, mine goes back to at least seventh grade, if not earlier, and whether it comes from a genetic disposition because it goes way back in both sides of my family, or it comes from the trauma of my dad being a person with alcoholism, it's been there a long time. So it's really foundational, and it appears as my own thoughts. It does a dead-on impression of my brain. And so when I succeed at something, my fundamental belief is that I'm bound for failure. So any success is just a forestalling of the inevitable collapse. Like, mm-hmm. when I succeed, I'm like, oh, this is going to make it so much harder when I inevitably fail in the future and when I'm discovered to be a fraud and all this. And I can manage that now. I mean, that is a deception. It's a cognitive distortion that my brain is doing. Now I'm aware of that and I can say, aha, that's not what's happening, you know, and I can manage around that. And unfortunately, that's the burden that I'm probably stuck with for life, is like my brain wants to go one way. I have to catch it, bring it back onto a different track. It gets to a point where this is my fourth book. You know, I've had success. I have people writing in and saying, this has genuinely helped me. And it's starting to really stick. It took a dumbly long time. But I also changed the goals in that time, because in creative work, there's so much that's beyond your control. Like, I don't read Amazon reviews. I don't check my Amazon ranking. I don't even really check download numbers for the podcast, because none of those things help me to do my job. But when I hear from people, this has helped me. You know, I'm getting getting into a therapist. I'm understanding my mom better, whatever it is. Like, that's the reward now. So that's a much easier one to savor.
John Moe is the author of The Hilarious World of Depression and host of the podcast of the same name. You mentioned you started the podcast in 2016, an eventful year in world history.
No.
And now we are in the, I won't say middle, at some point during a global pandemic.
Yeah.
So you're helping society in your way discuss mental illness. Does it ever feel like a burden?
Being the one to carry that conversation?
Yeah.
No, it doesn't. I mean, it's, I'm trying, and this is going to take a while, to kind of wean myself off the word stigma, because I was talking to someone on the show, who's a therapist who kind of specializes in the person first language model of saying, you know, I don't say my dad was an alcoholic. I say he was a person with alcoholism.
I noticed that you phrased it that way.
Yeah, because we aren't defined by one aspect of our lives, mm-hmm. and we're a person before everything else. And so I've been trying to wean off the word stigma in favor of discrimination, because that's what it is. You know, if you think that somebody with depression or an anxiety disorder is untrustworthy, you're discriminating against them. You're discriminating against something that they have no control over any more than, you know, any other form of discrimination. But I know, too, that there's just such a hunger for this stuff. I mean, I call up people to be on the show and, you know, we get a lot of yeses. We get occasional, you know, there's some very well-known friends of mine who say, I want to do the show. I'm not ready yet. I'm like, great. Mm-hmm. I'll check back once a year. And I do. And then, you know, some people were just working on getting them. But we get so many yeses. Like, I got a yes from Jeff Tweedy. We had Jeff Tweedy from Wilco on the show, which I could not believe, you know, and he said, well, I'm kind of busy. Can you just come down to the Wilco loft in Chicago and we could do it there? I'm like, yes, I can do that. I can go to Graceland, Elvis. You mean the studio where you recorded Yankee Hotel Foxtrot? Okay.
Yeah, I'm happy to look at those rugs.
Yeah, that's just fine. But like, I always think, well, I think I even asked him, maybe off mic, like, why did you say yes? Like, what do you have to gain? I'm not going to help sell out a Wilco show. They do that themselves. And he just said, well, I just thought it was cool and I could help people. And that's what really it comes down. And there's so many people like that, that when you get the more asinine assessment of what mental illness means, you can kind of gird yourself really well because you know you've got a lot of people on your team.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important to note how many very successful people are subject to this.
And productive
people. They get out there, like Jeff Tweedy.
Yeah.
Tours the world.
Yeah.
Runs a band. You know, has staff and a family. Like, writes songs, produces records. He has more than one band now.
Yeah.
He can do it. A lot of the time he can.
Can spend enough time with his kids that he'll start entire bands with his kids.
Yeah.
That's an amazing thing. No, I mean, and that's part of what we wanted to demonstrate too, and that these are people who have dealt with this, who are dealing with it, who are still doing their thing and creating. And, you know, we try to show too people who are in the middle of it and aren't doing so great. We had Aparna Nancherla on, who's a wonderful comedian. Mm-hmm. And she said, right now I'm not doing so well. This was way before COVID. She said, you know, the shows are taking a heavier toll on me than they used to. And we try to show that too. You know, it's all in the interest of, yes, talking about it is a positive sign and positive modeling, but, you know, it can be a lot of things.
You make yourself very available for the interviews. They can be long. You don't go in with notes, which you said in the book.
Yeah.
Does it take a toll on you or what? Does it take a toll on you? ?
It's the worst, man. I mean, it really does, because as you said, I go in just to follow the course of the conversation. My first question is whatever question is in my head right then. And we're talking about some heavy stuff. it never seems weird to me to talk about the things we're talking about. You know, I've had a lot of people say, well, how can you just ask them those deep questions? And it's usually because I spend all my time working on a podcast about this stuff that I forget that those are deep questions. And I try to follow my own instinct of curiosity, and that sometimes goes to those places. But yeah, I mean, I make myself available. I sometimes talk about myself in the interview, knowing I'm going to cut that part out later, but just to kind of prompt it. We had one interview, and I won't mention who, but I was asking about her father, and I think she was finally a little taken aback, and she's like, well, how often do you talk to your father? And I said, well, not much since he's been dead 20 years, but the conversations aren't all that different than when he was alive. yeah, I mean, I used to think I could just do a bunch of interviews back to back to back. But even when we go out to LA or New York to tape, I'm good for about two a day. And then usually I have to take a really deep nap right after that, because it is a lot of psychic weight.
Absolutely. And interviews are tiring anyway, because it's conversation plus plus. And if you're the host or the interviewee, we're like trading hats back and forth right now, maybe.
Well, it's hard.
It's tiring.
It's hard because it's not a conversation, but it's dressed up to look like one. And so, you know, as we talk now, there's a certain sort of angle of insight along a particular vein that you're trying to get from me. And I'm trying to give you what you need to do your job well and to fully illustrate what I'm doing in the podcast and the book. And that's why I think so many people, because there are so many podcasts right now, Sarah, there's no shortage.
Oh, are there?
Yeah. you know, the and often in the format of three white guys in a room agreeing with each other. But a lot of people think they can do interviews by having conversations, and those interviews fall flat because it is such a weird disguise of a conversation that the interview is dressed up in.
That's absolutely the case. John Moe is the author of The Hilarious World of Depression, published by St. Martin's Press. He's also the host of the podcast, The Hilarious World of Depression, which you can find where you find your podcasts. If you don't find podcasts yet, good for you, but also try to find this one. It's
find
very,
podcasts.
Very enjoyable. Find them. Fill time.
Yeah.
You've got time, maybe, and they will fill it.
Right.
John, thank you again so much for the book, for your work, for being my Twitter friend, and for doing this interview. I'm really psyched we connected, and I very much appreciate your time.
I know. Now we can read, like, listen to each other in more than 280 characters. It's very exciting.
Once again, John Moe is the author of The Hilarious World of Depression and host and creator of the podcast of the same name. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. We've posted links to a number of mental health resources along with this interview at wamc.org/roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.